This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's Friday. Senator Sanders is with us for our Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's senator, Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov. Senator, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. You are on the budget committee. I know there's a lot going on there, and it seems that the Republicans are drumming the war drums. What's on your mind?
I am the ranking member on the budget committee, meaning that as an independent, I caucus with the Democrats, and I am the lead person on the Democratic side. And this week, the Republicans, both in the House and the Senate, brought forth their proposed budgets. Yesterday, after I don't know, 6-7 hours of debate, the Senate Budget Committee voted out by a party line vote, 12-10. The Republican budget goes to the floor on Monday, and it'll be debated there all week. Tom, what a federal budget is about is it's not an appropriations bill where money goes directly into a particular agency, but it lays the blueprint for where money goes. It tells the appropriating committees that you have this much money to spend. So it plays a very important role in establishing national priorities. And not surprisingly, what the Republican budget in the House and in the Senate is about is laying the groundwork for more tax breaks for the people who need it the least and cuts in programs for people who need those programs the most. You know, when you talk about a budget, and I think in a sense every family in America, every business in America looks at a budget and you say, well, what are my needs? Where should I put my money? Where should I save money? If you look at what's going on in America today, I think most of us understand that the middle class over the last 40 years has been disappearing. In state after state, people are working longer hours for low wages. Parents are wondering how they're going to be able to send their kids to college or provide child care for their little ones. You have older workers wondering about how they're going to be able to retire with dignity. That is the playing field for ordinary Americans. They're struggling. And what the Republican budget says to those people who are struggling, we're going to make your life a little bit harder. If you're having trouble feeding your family, we're going to cut back on food stamps and other nutrition programs. If you are having difficulty saving up to go to college, we're going to cut back on Pell Grants. If you are living on Medicare, we're going to tighten that up and ask you perhaps to pay some more. So the entire Republican budget is geared toward saving money by going after the programs that the middle class and working families of this country depend upon. On the other hand, at a time when the wealthiest people are doing phenomenally well and corporate profits are exploding, what the Republican budget says, well, the rich are not quite rich enough, and we'll lay the groundwork for lowering individual tax rates for the 1% and corporate tax rates as well. So I have described their budget as a budget based on the Robin Hood principle in reverse. They're taking from the poor and working families and giving to the wealthy and large corporations. But then on top of all of that, what the Republicans are saying is, you know, we are spending somewhere around $600 billion a year on the military, more than the next 9 countries combined. We have spent between $3 and $6 trillion, or will spend, fighting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and taking care of the veterans who fought those wars. But that's not enough. We need to be spending even more on the military. And one of the interesting aspects of the committee debate yesterday was an amendment that asked for another $38 billion for the military to be off budget, to be part of what's called the overseas contingency account, which is not part of the overall budget. It's emergency funding. So our Republicans who lecture the American people every day about how we have to cut back on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and education and nutrition and infrastructure, all the important things, when it comes to spending money on a military, it's not a problem, and we don't have to worry about the deficit. So all of that leads me to two conclusions which worry me in both instances. Number one, I have the feeling, based on this letter that 47 Republicans wrote to the Ayatollah, that they really do not want an agreement with Iran in which Iran ceases to have the ability to create nuclear weapons. Some of them, at least, would prefer a war with Iran. And I think they also would prefer a war with ISIS. So after two disastrous wars, which have cost us some 6,700 brave young Americans, have led to 500,000 coming home with PTSD or TBI, led to the cost of between $3 and $6 trillion by the time we take care of the last veteran. Apparently these guys want more. Two wars is not enough. And maybe we can get a third war, maybe even a fourth war. And it's not clear, but my guess is they don't intend to pay for those wars either. Just add it on to the deficit. And then when the deficit goes up, we can talk about the absolute need to cut Social Security and Medicare, with even more, stringent, tone. So, that is where the, budget debate was. It will be on the floor, as I said, Monday, and we'll see what happens. But I would hope that the president gets out his veto pen and makes sure that when this budget is converted into appropriations bills, that he makes certain that the Republican ideas do not prevail.
Go ahead.
No, that's okay.
Okay, so the process here is the Republicans put forward basically a statement of intent and goals.
Well, it's more than that. It's more than intent and goals. It is that, but it is also a real firm dollar amount as to how much the United States government can spend. Mm-hmm. What it's like if I say to you, okay, you got $100, and that's all you can spend, but you determine how that $100 is spent.
I see.
But if I say you got $120, well, you have more money to play with. Or if I say $80, you have less money to play with.
Right.
So what they are saying is we want less money available for the needs of working families and the middle class. We want more money available for the middle, for the upper class. We want more money available for the military.
Right.
So they lay the groundwork, and then the committees fill in the blanks.
So we, you know, during the early years of President Obama's presidency, as I recall, we had a number of years there where there was no budget. Congress couldn't come to one. Right. Is that a possibility? And if so, what happens? Do we just roll over last year's budget?
It will be a budget. I think it'll be a bad budget. But I think the Republicans now control both houses. And I think they will come up with a budget. But at the end of the day, this budget gets converted into real legislation as to how much money we spend on defense, how much money we spend on food stamps, how much money we spend on education, how much money we spend on this, that, and the other thing. So the Republican, you know, and that's where we are. Now, the alternative budget, in a sense, the proposals that I and other members of the Democratic caucus brought forward were very, very different. Our goals were at a time when real unemployment is around 11% and youth unemployment is somewhere around 17%, and African-American youth unemployment is much higher than that. We said there's a real need now to create millions of decent-paying jobs, and the best way to do that is to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. I offered that amendment. We didn't get one Republican vote in support of it.
That makes me crazy. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be right back with your calls for Senator Sanders on our Brunch with Bernie Friday. We'll be back right after this, 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Be sure to check out Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz. You can hop from there over to his Facebook page. So, Senator, ready to take some calls?
Let's do it.
Okay, Cynthia in College Station, Texas. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders. I had a question about Social Security. What I was wondering is, okay, so they're already going to cut Social Security, but does that mean it's going to go into effect this year? And also, could it be filibuster or the president veto this?
Yes. Thank you very much.
I'm close to retiring.
Okay. Here's where we are with that. Last week, I accepted petitions, 2 million petitions from seniors and others all over this country. And what they said loudly and clearly, and that was organized by the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, but other senior groups are active as well. And what the petition said is, look, you can't cut Social Security. You have millions of elderly people trying to survive in today's world on $12,000, $13,000, $14,000 a year. You got disabled vets trying to survive as best they can who receive Social Security. Do not cut Social Security. Well, I think we have put enough pressure on the Republicans, so I'm happy to say. Now, everything can change tomorrow, but the truth is, in the Republican Senate budget, there were no proposals to cut Social Security. It was a very bad budget, but they did leave out Social Security. More or less the same in the House budget. They've called for a study effort. So I think for the moment, at least, we have once again, against great pressure, from the business roundtable, from the corporate world, we have beat back, at the moment at least, I'm not going to tell you it won't change tomorrow, efforts to cut Social Security. Now, the ideas that have been out there that the Republicans have brought forth on our, in our various committee hearings are raise the retirement age to 70, raise the retirement age of Medicare to 70, the so-called chain CPI, which changes the way we define what a COLA is, which would lower COLA substantially for seniors and disabled vets. But, Cynthia, for the moment at least, we have beat back efforts to cut Social Security, and I'm going to be very, very vigilant on that issue.
Diana in Agoura Hills, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning, and it's always an honor to speak to you both. I do have a question for Senator Sanders, but first I want to say I'm super excited to be attending the Sister Giant Conference on March 28th and 29th. I can only attend one day, so I purchased both a ticket to attend the one day and purchased a ticket to see it live stream.
Right.
That's how excited I am to miss out on any of it. So I hope you will say something about your appearances there and the rest of the honor.
Sure, and Mary Ann's going to be with us in a little bit. Diana, we're down to about 15 seconds in this.
It's been a quick question. Senator Sanders is, I have already made a contribution to your presidential campaign. I will be continuing to contribute as I can, and I want to know what the status of your campaign organization and how that all is shaping up.
Where are we at?
Well, Diana, thank you very much for your support. We'll look forward to seeing you at the Sister Giant event next Saturday in Los Angeles. Well, let's get back to that when the break is over.
Okay, great. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. Sanders.Senate.gov. Check it out. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls live. And, Senator, one of our callers wanted to know how your presidential campaign is going. Are you possible? The possibility.
Well, let's put the possible. It is, when you run for president of the United States of America, that is a mammoth undertaking, and you have to do it well.
Yeah.
And what we are doing when I'm out in California, we'll be talking to folks out there and seeing what kind of support exists there. The two issues that three issues that we have to address is when you take on the most powerful special interest in this country and Wall Street and the big energy companies and the military industrial complex and the drug companies and so forth and so on, can we rally and put together the kind of grassroots organization that we need to run a strong campaign in 50 states in America? And it's a lot easier to talk about it than actually putting it together. Are there millions of people who are prepared to work hard to take on the billionaire class? And the answer is that's what we're trying to ascertain. And the second issue, of course, comes down to the ugly situation of money. As a result of Citizens United, the billionaire class is, prepared to buy candidates and buy elections all over this country. And one needs to raise hundreds of millions of dollars to run a strong campaign. And they have to be, in my case, they will, if I run, will be based on kind of small and modest individual contributions. And you're going to need literally millions of them. And is there that kind of support? So I have no doubt, Tom, that the issues that we are raising, which is saying that we cannot continue the assault on the middle class and working families, we cannot continue never-ending wars, we cannot continue to ignore the crisis of climate change or the unaffordability of college or the growing and grotesque income and wealth inequality in this country. These are issues that have to be dealt with. And I know that there are millions and millions of people who feel as strongly as I do about these issues. But in the real world that we live in, where money has so much sway over the political process, where media determines what they will cover and what they will not cover, who's worth covering, who's not worth covering, these are all issues that have to be taken into consideration. But, you know, we'll make a decision as soon as we can.
And just FYI, for anybody on the West Coast who wants to see Bernie, Senator Sanders and me, both of us will be in Los Angeles 1 week from tomorrow at Marianne Williamson's Sister Giant event in Los Angeles, in Santa Monica, actually. And Marianne will be with us later on in the program.
Well, and I wanted to thank Marianne very much for not only putting on that wonderful event, which has been so successful in the last couple of years, but for inviting me. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. Daniel, in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Hi, Tom. I wanted to ask Senator Sanders, should Michael Froman be fired? Yesterday, Peter DeFazio was saying how Froman was pitching the TPP.
Hang on just a second, Daniel. Just for people who don't know who you're talking about, this is the guy who, on behalf of the Obama administration, is negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Back to you, Daniel.
Okay, thank you. He was pitching the TPP to that special session of Congress where we can actually take a look at the agreement now. Lucky us, huh? Mm-hmm. And he was saying how, well, we got 20,000 extra cars to the Koreans. And Representative DeFazio said, well, how many more now are the Koreans importing into us? And he didn't know. Well, the answer is 400,000. And, I mean, so many people are out of work because of these agreements. And I'm like, this guy should be, in my opinion, it's a fireable offense. He doesn't have any grasp on the facts. This was a minute detail he should have had down pat.
Well, Daniel, let me just say this. In my view, when we talk about the disappearance of the American middle class, and when we talk about the significant decline in manufacturing in America, and when we talk about why real wages have gone way, way down, I think an important part of that discussion has got to be our disastrous trade policies, which stretch back well over 30 years, and that is the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, CAFTA, trade agreements with China, and one has got to take a deep breath and say, okay, has unfettered free trade worked for the American middle class? That's a simple question. We have free trade agreements with Mexico as part of NAFTA. We have the Chinese free trade agreement. Are they working? Has the result of these trade agreements been the creation of millions of good-paying jobs in this country as we export our products to other nations? I think any objective assessment of these trade agreements tells us that, by and large, they have been disastrous. Our trade deficit has soared. We have, since 2001, lost 60,000 factories in the United States of America, 60,000 factories and millions of decent-paying manufacturing jobs. Not all of it can be attributed to trade. There are other reasons as well. But a lot of it can be. Now, this TPP, and by the way, when you talk about Furman is simply doing the bidding in this case. He's representing the President of the United States. And I have a lot of agreements with President Obama on issues. In some areas, I strongly disagree with him. And on this issue, I strongly disagree. In Vietnam, the minimum wage is now 56 cents an hour. It's actually gone up 56 cents an hour. Do we really want American workers to be competing against people in Vietnam who make 56 cents an hour? I don't think so. So to me, TPP is simply the culmination of and another step forward based on the same principles of the disastrous trade agreements we've had in the past. But by the way, it is not only forcing American workers to compete against low-wage workers around the rest of the world. What it also does is creates situations where if you're a pharmaceutical industry, who have been very active in these negotiations, you can force poorer countries around the world to pay higher prices than they otherwise would pay because you could prevent the rapid introduction of generics into the country, forcing them to pay for brand names. It also is that if you are a state or a federal government here in the United States and you pass environmental legislation or other types of legislation, that legislation could be overridden by an independent international jury that protects the interests of large corporations.
Remarkable stuff. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls at our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back right after the news here at the bottom of the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, and then you can hop over to Facebook and check out his Facebook page there. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. And, Senator, you're there?
I'm right here.
Okay, great. Florence in Rainier, Washington. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, hi there, Senator. We're wondering if you could come to Washington State the weekend of April the 18th. We have large venues on hold in Seattle and Tacoma and Olympia. PDA sent the itinerary to your people. Please, could you tell them you'd like to come?
Well, I would love to come at some point. I just don't know if what my schedule is. But we will, if you've sent us the invitation, we will get back to you, and we would love to come to Seattle at some point.
Thank you, Florence. Thank you. Jason in Washington, D.C., you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, guys. First thing, I think we need to correct Robin Hood. Robin Hood took money from the tax collector and returned it to the people who were overtaxed. But I wanted to address ethanol subsidies. Can we agree that this is a complete failure and an environmental disaster and this policy needs to stop?
Among many other energy issues, I think it's one that we want to take a hard look at. I think one of the concerns is that around the world, the degree to which we put increased emphasis on corn for ethanol has an impact on food prices. But it is an issue that needs to be looked at very hard.
John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, I had, I guess, more of a comment, but about TPP and what can be done about this. I think this is one of the most significant issues for any lawmaker because essentially what we're doing is we're trading away our power to the TPP. And, you know, this is just abysmal. People can read the record of NAFTA and see what has happened. I mean, some of the suits were absolutely ridiculous, but this is, you know, just not a good thing. And every union has come together in this country officially to, you know, be against TPP. This is going to, you know, talk about destroying the middle class. It's going to depress wages. It's going to affect drugs. It's going to do innumerable things. Tom has brought this up before. And so that's all I want to say. I don't want to take too much time, but I'll just.
Well, John. Jason is absolutely right, and this TPP is a continuation, as I mentioned a moment ago, of trade policy written by the large multinational corporations, which will work for the large multinational corporations, but be a disaster not only for working families, but I think, as Jason indicated, for our national sovereignty as well. You know, we kind of believe or are taught that democracy means we, the people, vote and elect people and make laws which work for us. But what happens in this process is some large corporation who feels aggrieved by a decision made by the federal government or a state government. Maybe it's a food safety issue. Maybe it is an environmental issue. And they go to the some board, an international board, and say, look, we are supposed to be able to make as much money as we can in the state of Vermont in the United States, and they've passed legislation, environmental legislation, food safety legislation, and it's limiting our ability to make money. And the goal here of the trade agreement is to maximize profits for corporations. And if this international board looks and says, well, you're right, you're restricting, this legislation is restricting your ability to make money. That's the criteria. We got to overturn those laws. So laws that were voted upon by the people of states or of America or of other countries. One example comes to mind, a particularly outrageous example. I believe, Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was Uruguay, small little country, that passed legislation to try to help prevent children from smoking. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, yeah. And the tobacco company sued them under CAFTA or NAFTA or something.
Right. So here
WTO,
you have,
whatever it was.
A little country is trying, in terms of public health, to do the right thing. Maybe it's by labeling on the cigarette packages. I don't know exactly what it was.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Okay, and saying, warning people about the danger of smoking, doing everything they can to prevent kids from getting addicted to tobacco. And the cigarette companies say, you're ruining our ability to make money. We want to sell tobacco products to kids there. Get them hooked. And how dare you limit our profit-making operations? And I think as a result of that, what, Uruguay had to withdraw its efforts or cease its efforts?
I'm not sure where it's at right now.
Yeah, and nor am I. But, if you're a small country like Uruguay taking on the multi-billion-dollar tobacco industry, you know, having to go to court and defend it, millions of dollars. So this is exactly the issue. In this case, a country like Uruguay tries to do the right thing, and they're taking on big tobacco and have to go before a board whose criteria is this impacting not the health of the people of that country, the children of that country, but whether it impacts the profits of the tobacco industry.
Right. Billy in Phoenix, Arizona. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, how are you guys? Senator, I have a question for you. We live in a society here in America where majority of people don't even know that there is a midterm elections, which have consequences. They don't even know there's midterm elections at all. My question is, and Tom had the subject yesterday, I wonder if there's any way possible one day we'll have mandatory voting in this country, and if not mandatory, make it easier by some sort of app that goes on kids' smartphones or adult smartphones to let them know there's elections coming up, or to let them know that they're not registered and they can register via their app, and so on and so forth. This is something I've been going over in my mind quite often, so I just wondered.
Well, Billy, thanks a lot for raising that issue. I worry very much, and Tom and I over the years have discussed this issue often, about the future of American democracy. As Billy indicates, in the last midterm election we had, some 63% of the American people did not vote. Some 80% of young people did not vote. An equal number of low-income working people did not vote. And at the same time, the billionaire class, Koch brothers and others, are spending hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to elect right-wing candidates who will work for their benefits. And that's the dynamic. And then on top of that, you have many states who are literally trying to make it harder, are trying to suppress the vote with all kinds of so-called anti-voter fraud legislation, which will make it more complicated for seniors and lower-income people to be able to participate. That's the landscape that we're seeing now in terms of the political process. And now my view is that we have to address this issue very frontly. You have countries in Europe, Denmark comes to mind, where 80, 85, 90% of the people participate in the elections, not 36%. So we have got to make it easier for people to vote. We have got to demand that the media talks about the real issues facing people so that people understand the significance of elections. I always, you know, get startled when I hear you talk to people and say, oh, election's still crap, it doesn't matter, I'm not going to bother to vote. Meanwhile, the Koch brothers spend hundreds of millions of dollars on elections. So why is it that the richest people think that politics is really, really important, and many working people say, oh, it doesn't matter, I'm not going to vote? I think we should pay attention to what the Koch brothers do. They think elections are very important. They know that what goes on in the White House and Congress is very important. So I think Billy raises a very important issue. There are many things that we can do. I have proposed legislation, introduced legislation, calling for an election day holiday We should take a day off during the year to celebrate democracy, where people will have the time to vote. We should work on various approaches to make it easier, whether it's postcards or same-day registration or lengthening the amount of time in which people can register to vote. But the goal is to create an inclusive democracy, to be proud when more people participate, not to go out of our way, as our many Republican governors are doing, to make it harder for people to participate.
Norma, in Montgomery, Alabama, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, thank you. Senator Sanders, I wanted to commend you on not losing your temper yesterday, particularly when my senator says he wants once again to cut the funding for Meals on Wheels, which feeds most of my neighbors. But also I wanted to ask you to please let people understand that if this TPP passes, our standards are so very low that at most of us could wind up eating radioactive fish across the country because if a trade agreement with China says we import it, what will we do with it? Thank you.
All right. Well, Norma raises the same very good point. Understand that these agreements, and here's from a political perspective, and again, it talks why people are so discouraged and disillusioned with what goes on in Washington. All of the major trade agreements have been supported by Republican presidents. You've got Reagan, Bush 1, Bush 2. You have Democratic presidents, Clinton, Obama. And corporate America has understood from day one that creating a global economy where they can move their manufacturing plants to low-wage countries, where they can outsource non-manufacturing jobs. Right now, you know, the Internet is global. And why do you want to pay somebody $20-25 an hour in the United States to work on a computer when you can pay somebody a third of that price in India or Russia or someplace else? That's what corporate America has understood. You go to those places where wages are low, are lowest. But what Norma also raises is the fact that we will be sued by countries when we try to do the right thing to protect food safety or the environment.
More of your questions for Senator Sanders right after this. Stick around. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And visit Sanders.Senate.gov for, you know, it's a great news site. You can sign up for Bernie's newsletter. It's just an enormous amount of useful stuff there. Welcome back. Larry in Williamsburg, Iowa, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish satellite. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, I was just curious on what they're doing on the post office and if there's any movement on getting the money back to the people who are disabled instead of cutting.
All right, thanks, Larry, for asking that. This is an issue I have been working on for years, along with some other people in the Senate. We've had some success and some failures. I am very, very worried about what's going on with the post office right now. We were unable. We came close to putting together an agreement, but we didn't, to lower delivery standards. So I think I'm hearing in Vermont, and if people want to call up about this, I'd love to hear from them, but we're hearing now that mail delivery is significantly slower than it used to be. Right now, there is an effort afoot fairly shortly to start closing 82 processing plants around the country, which will impact some 15,000 workers. All of this stuff are things that I and other members of the Senate have been trying to prevent. And I think what Larry may be talking about is that every single year, and as a result of a decision made during the Bush administration, the Postal Service has to come up with $5.5 billion in future retirement benefits for their workers, health benefits for their workers. $5.5 billion every single year. They have more than enough money in that fund now to cover workers for decades. And we're trying to stop the post office from having to make those payments. So this issue of how you protect the U.S. Postal Service, how you make sure that its delivery standards are reasonable, how we give them the opportunity to earn more money is something, Larry, that I can tell you we are working on very, very hard. In fact, I think during the budget process, I will likely bring forth an amendment which tries to restore the delivery standards to where they were before.
Great. Ken, in Parrington, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you. It's an honor to speak to you, Senator.
Thank you.
I have just one question. I'm a political activist in Michigan, and what can I do that will have the most impact to help you get on the ballot to be our next president?
Oh, that's very kind of you, Ken. You know, what we need, and I, here's the dilemma that we face, Ken. I think that there is very, very strong support for the agenda that we are talking about, which is rebuilding our infrastructure, creating millions of jobs doing that, raising the minimum wage, dealing with pay equity, dealing with a fraudulent system of overtime, dealing with income and wealth inequality. Poll after poll tells us the American people want the rich and large corporations to start paying their fair share of taxes, climate change, all of that stuff. But what we need to do, and it's not just for me, we need to know to go forward that we're going to do well. Because if we don't do well, it's not just my ego that suffers. That's not important. But then our opponents say, see, all of these issues that Sanders is talking about, nobody really supports them. Nobody really wants a job program to rebuild the infrastructure and create millions of jobs. Nobody really cares about raising the minimum wage to a living wage. Nobody really cares that the top one-tenth of 1% own more wealth than the bottom 90%. How do we make people know that people do care about these issues? So, Ken, anything you can do, you know, to rally grassroots activists to a progressive agenda, that would be fantastic.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Sanders taking your calls. More in just a moment. Ten minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Mike in Chicago, you are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, great to talk to you. Senator, besides jobs, my generation, and I'm 40 years old, I'm concerned about the national debt, and my 75-year-old father and I have gotten a disagreement about this. He doesn't view it as being important. I understand, you know, he's concerned about Medicare and Social Security, but your generation does not have to pay the money back. I do, and my future, you know, kids and their children. So, and besides that, approximately $250 billion a year comes out of the budget to finance that debt. So, am I wrong, or
well,
can you help me out here? And why do you think I'm wrong?
Mike, thanks very much for the question. It's a very important issue. And, you know, the arguments that your father and you are having are probably taking place all over America. So let me just say this about the debt and the deficit. Deficit today is somewhere around $480 billion, significantly less. It's gone down by about two-thirds since Obama has been president. When he came in, it was like $1.4 trillion. National debt has gone up. It's now about $18 trillion. Is that an issue that we should be concerned about? The answer is absolutely we should be. The debate is the best way to deal with the deficit and the national debt. In terms of Social Security has enough money in its trust fund, Mike, to pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 18 years, about $2.8 trillion in the trust fund. The way we should address Social Security to prolong its solvency and, in fact, expand benefits is to lift the cap on taxable income, which is now at $118,000. If you start at $250,000 and lift that cap, we can make Social Security solvent till the year 2061 and expand benefits as well. So, Mike, I think in terms of Social Security, that's what we have to do. But when you talk about the debt and the deficit, it's also important to understand how income and wealth inequality has exacerbated that problem. For example, in terms of Social Security, if we had the same levels of income and wealth inequality as we had in 1985, Social Security would have 20 years more solvency because people would have been making more money and paying more taxes into the Social Security Trust Fund. second of all, if you want to deal with the deficit and the debt, what's the best way to do it? The best way to do it, in my view, is to end all of these corporate tax loopholes that prevent corporations from paying about $100 billion every single year in taxes in the United States. So the answer is deficit and debt are important, but what is even more important are creating jobs, putting people to work, creating a full employment economy, because not only does that improve the middle class, it generates more tax revenue, which will help us lower the debt and the deficit. So, long answer to a short question, but it's a complicated issue.
It's a good one. Jim in Lockport, Illinois, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Tom. Senator Sanders.
Hi.
Senator Sanders, first of all, a little shout-out to Ed Schultz. He's been on that TPP issue for quite some time, and I think we should all give him a little shout-out.
Amen.
Very important issue. But my question to you, Senator Sanders, is, you know, Republicans always think they have the best ideas for this country. And I was always wondering, if their ideas are so great and they think Democrats are so wrong, why don't they allow the Democrats to run with their ideas? And if they failed, wouldn't they be proven right? Wouldn't they take over the White House and everything else?
Well, let me say a couple of things, Jim. In terms of the TPP and Ed and Tom, Tom, I may be wrong. My information may be outdated right now. But there was a study that came out a few months ago which pointed out that the major television networks have failed to discuss the largest trade agreement in the history of the United States, the TPP, at all.
Yeah, I think the one guy in all of television who's talking about it is Ed, and the one guy in radio who's talking about it is me. There doesn't seem to be much more.
So, I mean, this gets back to a whole other issue, you know, and that is the role of corporate media in allowing people to understand what's going on. The largest trade agreement in the history of the United States, the major networks, the most powerful media force in our country have failed to mention the TPP.
Right.
In terms of ideas, you know, Jim, I do not, you know, the Republicans' ideas, I used to think that they were serious ideas brought forth by serious people. You know, we can disagree, but really they're not. What they are is ideology developed by the billionaire class to serve their needs. If you are the Koch brothers and another billionaire, you want to pay less in taxes. That's the simple truth. If you're a greedy guy and you don't care about anybody else, you want to pay less in taxes. So you hire some guys to explain, tell the American people why it is good for them that billionaires pay less in taxes. So they come up with all these theories. Tell the American people, if I want to end Medicare, tell the American people why. And I want to pay less in taxes because I'm a billionaire. Tell the American people why it is a good idea for us to end Medicaid or cut back significantly or Medicare or community health centers. Tell the American people why. Come up with some convoluted theory. And the theory is, well, if we have competition in the marketplace, healthcare marketplace, they will lower prices and improve quality. Total bogus, but it's the theory. So what I'm saying, Jim, I really don't think, you know, I respect people who have different points of view. But I honestly don't believe that what we are engaged in now is some kind of great intellectual debate about issues. I think what essentially the Republican agenda is an agenda paid for by the wealthiest people in this country. They hire folks, you know, if I am in the coal industry and I want to keep making profits, I hire somebody to tell the world why climate change is not real. Are we debating climate change, or is this just an effort by the coal industry to make more money? Kind of that's my view of where this debate is.
Yeah. It's brilliant. Senator Sanders, thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay, Tom, thank you.
Great talking. Up next, Marianne Williamson, and then Anything Goes Friday. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Marianne will be with us in an hour, actually. So we're in anything goes Friday territory right now. A couple of quick stories to share with you. There is no limit to the Republican disrespect of President Obama. There's just no limit to it. Mitch McConnell had promised the president and all of us that Loretta Lynch would get a vote by the end of this week. Today is the end of this week. No vote for Loretta Lynch. The white guy got a vote, right? Ash Carter for defense secretary. But the black woman who's going to become the attorney general, no, no votes for her. Even though she's arguably one of the most highly qualified AGs that we've ever had. Nah, no vote. No, Republicans are not objecting to Loretta Lynch. They just like dissing the president. Along those same lines, Mitch McConnell has now said, yeah, as a senator, I can't stop the president from, for example, trying to work out a deal with Iran. But, you know, I'll participate with John Boehner trying to blow it up. And now he's saying, you know, as a senator, I can't stop the president from promulgating new regulations for the EPA to reduce the consequences on all Americans of burning coal. But, well, here's the article. This is Coral Davenport writing in today's New York Times. The headline, McConnell urges states to help thwart Obama's war on coal. Since McConnell is limited in how he can use his role in the Senate to block regulations, he has taken the unusual step of reaching out to governors with a legal blueprint for them to follow to stop the rules in their state. Mr. McConnell's Senate staff is coordinating with lawyers and lobbying firms. Isn't that sweet of them? Coordinate with the lobbying firms, the bribers and the bribee. They're coordinating with lawyers and lobbying firms to help to try to ensure that the state plans are tangled up in legal delays. On Thursday, Mr. McConnell sent a detailed letter to every governor in the United States, laying out a carefully researched legal argument as to why states should not comply with Mr. Obama's regulations. So President Obama wants to do something. He wants to make the air a little cleaner. Nope, sorry, you can't do that. And we are going to send a letter to all 50 governors telling them how to stick it in your eye, President Obama. President Obama says, "Hey, let's work out a deal with Iran so that they don't become a nuclear power." And Mitch McConnell and John Boehner say, "No, we're not going to do that either. We're going to send a nasty letter." It was Tom Cotton wrote the thing. Mitch McConnell signed it, and with his imprimatur, you know, 46 other Republican senators signed it. So Tom Cotton now, you know, this is the new Republican strategy, right? President tries to do something. They send a letter to somebody saying, no, don't participate with President Obama. He's only here for a couple more years. He's the temporary guy. Wait for us Republicans to come back into power. This is a variation on what Richard Nixon said to the South Vietnamese in 1968. Just hang on. Just wait. And here's where it gets astonishing. Tom Cotton, who wrote the letter to Iran to meddle in this administration's negotiations with a foreign power, said about the Obama administration saying to Israel, we are going to we are currently evaluating our approach to Israel. This is what Jen Psaki of the State Department said yesterday. And so Tom Cotton, oh really? We're reevaluating our relationship. He says this raises the question, of course, if the administration intends to undermine Prime Minister Netanyahu's efforts to assemble a coalition by suggesting a change to our longstanding policy of supporting Israel's position with the UN. So Tom Cotton is now all worried that we might be interfering, undermining is the word he used, foreign officials who are currently in negotiations, the phrase that he used. Very interesting. Steve Bannon, writing in Rachel Maddow's blog over at MSNBC, he updates this. He says, in his remarks on the Senate floor, Cotton added, I fear mutual respect is of little concern to this administration. Tom, pick up a psychology dictionary and look up the word projection. I'm serious. Did you see this story in New York? There was a school, there is a school about 60 miles northwest of New York City. It's called the Pine Bush High School. And last week was National Foreign Language Week, right? Declared by Congress, National Foreign Language Week. And so the foreign language department in that school arranged to have the Pledge of Allegiance, which they read over the school's PA every day, read in different languages every day throughout the week. You got a German version on Monday, you got a French version on Tuesday, you got an Arabic version on Wednesday. Wait a minute, Arabic? Oh my God. The district in a statement said the intention was to promote the fact that those who speak a language other than English still pledge to salute this great country. But no. A bunch of parents who lost relatives in Afghanistan said that they were offended by the fact that Arabic was spoken in the school to say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, the American Pledge of Allegiance. This kind of bizarre, hyperventilating straw man outrage largely only exists in the realm of right-wing hate radio and Fox so-called news. So I have to guess that probably one of those families called either a local right-wing hate radio host or Fox News and said, oh, my God, they're speaking Arabic in my school or my kid's school. And it became a because the school actually apologized for this. Now, CAIR, the Council on Arab on C-A-I-R, Council on American Islamic Relations, CAIR. CAIR has come out and said, you're apologizing for speaking Arabic? Really? That's what you want to be doing? I'm with them. Finally, Ted Cruz has doubled down on how he does not understand what Common Core is. Jed Legume, writing over at the Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org, he says, every statement, every assertion, there are three of them, every assertion in this statement by Ted Cruz is false, is a lie. On Sunday, Ted Cruz said he was going to repeal every word of Common Core if he became president. He tweeted, the federal government has no business sticking its nose in education. We need to repeal every word of Common Core. Here's what his spokeswoman said. Common Core is federally created curriculum. No, it's not. There's no curriculum with Common Core. She goes on to say, so if a state does not adopt the standards, it gives up the grant money. No, there's no federal grant money. But since the federal government created this mess, there should be a way to undo it. No, Common Core was not created by the federal government. It was a voluntary association of states who got together, you know, back in the era when Jeb Bush was governor of Florida, one of the reasons he likes it, a voluntary association of states who got together and said, here are some goals for math and English. And it's only math and English. The curriculum is left to the schools, the teachers, the principals. The race to the top grants were never part of Common Core. I mean, this is truly astonishing. how uninformed or malinformed or misinformed. I mean, you know, Ted Cruz and the people on his staff, if they're this stupid about Common Core, which is something that they're publicly speaking out about, it must be that they've been watching Fox so-called news. Because more than half the time, the news on Fox News isn't actually true.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Let me rephrase that. When people are misinformed, they're more likely to have been watching Fox News than any other news source in America. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Deb in Hobart, Indiana, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Deb, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Hope you're having a great day.
I am.
Awesome.
I hope you are, too.
I am calling about President Obama had mentioned about mandatory voting.
Right.
And I'm all for that. I think that's awesome. More people vote, the better we are. But it occurred to me that maybe if we coupled that with vote by mail, ballots by mail,
mm-hmm.
that we could eliminate a lot of the problems with the voter suppression. They wouldn't have to worry about voting machines being rigged, that kind of thing.
Right.
I wondered about your thoughts on that.
Yeah.
It'll also help out the post office.
Well, this is, you know, this will cause Brad Friedman to call in. I mean, the voting machines, I think, you know, frankly, I think vote by mail is a big step up from using voting machines in a polling place.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a variation on a voting machine that's used to count the vote by mail ballots. They're also they're ESNS or Diebold scanners. They're the same kind of scanners that grade tests in college and high school. But there are these scanners, and they're just as vulnerable to hacking and programming as anything else. What we need is A, vote by mail. B, the scanners need to be owned by the government, not leased from one of these private for-profit corporations. And C, the software, the way that the scanners work, needs to be absolute open source. It needs to be available to anybody and everybody. We need to be able to know that, you know, that the votes are real and all that sort of thing. With regard to mandatory voting, I think it would be a great idea, too. I'm not sure how to implement it in the United States in ways that don't, you know, confront our Constitution. But great stuff, Deb. Thank you for the call. Great point. Brian in Fitchburg, Mass. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Yeah, you know, I don't have a computer. I'm not online or any of that, but
mm-hmm.
I do vote. And in Massachusetts here, the last voting thing is Guy Seth, this young guy who was in the Iraq War, ran for Congress, Democrat. I'd never seen him on the news, you know, debating or telling us what he's running, what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And you know, the only thing I heard him say is he's going to compromise with the Republicans. That's about the only thing I heard him say.
Yikes. Well, you might want to contact his office and ask him what's going on, see if you can get
I like doing that with all our places, and the numbers never work. I'm just saying, yeah. who in this of the whole state, why isn't there 100 people running?
Yeah. Well, in part because, you know, the Supreme Court has turned our election system over to rich people, and so if you're not independently wealthy like Carly Fiorina, or if you're not you know, supported by people who are independently wealthy, like Scott Walker, then you got nothing. And I think people get it. People get it that the game has been rigged. The system is corrupt. You know, it's so.
What do we do about it?
Pardon?
What do we do about it?
We need to clean the system up. I mean, people are legitimately skeptical and legitimately cynical. The you know, to use Elizabeth Warren's comment about the financial system, you know, the game is rigged. Well, that's true of the political system to a large extent as well. And the way to unrig the system is to get money out of it. Now, the problem is that the Supreme Court has been aggressively inserting money into our elections ever since 1976 with the Buckley case, and certainly since Citizens United. And so in order to get money out of our elections, we have to go around or go through the Supreme Court. And that's why I encourage people to go to movetoamend.org, and we can do something about this. Brian, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program, and I've laid out a few things we can talk about, and there, oh, by the way, this was on alternate. From helping with cancer to depression, turmeric can do amazing things for your health. It's interesting. A lot of people take the concentrate from turmeric. It's called curcumin. But there's a fascinating video over at nutritionfacts.org where the guy who runs that site, Dr. Gerber, anyhow, he says that, or he cites some studies that indicate that taking whole herb turmeric every day, 700 milligrams every day, will actually diminish, it can stop and maybe even reverse Alzheimer's, at least certain kinds of dementia. But it's the whole herb. And then there was another study that Louise found over the weekend that showed that taking fish oil capsules doesn't help with heart health or brain health, but eating fish does. So it's like whole fish, whole turmeric. I'm really seeing a trend here. You know, it's and then on top of that, I don't know if you've seen the studies that have come out over the last couple of weeks on processed foods. I mean, this is brand new science. It is amazing stuff. What they found is that when people eat emulsifiers or surfactants, then they have deep and profound bad reactions to them. Emulsifiers and surfactants, here's what they are. Emulsifiers are things that mix things that normally don't go together. In other words, you take a glass of water and pour some olive oil into it, and the two are going to be separate, right? The oil is either going to float on the top or settle at the bottom. I forget which. I think it floats on the top. And the water will be the other one, and, you know, they'll be separate. You put a drop of detergent into that, which is both a surfactant and an emulsifier. Usually it's sodium dodecyl sulfate or one of these other similar compounds. Sodium lauryl sulfate is used heavily in shampoos, for example. You put a drop of that in there, and what it does is it causes the entire cell membranes of anything that this comes into contact with to get wet, essentially. It's like a wetting agent. And what we know is that when people eat these surfactants and emulsifiers, the wetting agent then does its thing, not just on the food, but apparently also A, on the bacteria in your gut, and B, on the cells and the lining of your small and large intestine. And in the process, it damages those cells and it screws up or kills off the bacteria. People end up with diarrhea. They end up with irritable bowel syndrome. They end up with lifelong problems as a consequence of eating emulsifiers and surfactants. Now, okay, so, you know, don't drink detergent, right? But here's the problem. If you look on, like, sodium carboxymethyl cellulose, it's one of the surfactants. Look on, and it's also used as a bulking agent, as a filling agent, and as an emulsifier in a lot of processed foods. Look on the labels, and you'll see these, you know, long, you know, sodium dodecyl sulfate, you know, carboxymethylcellulose, those kind of things. You'll see these long words on processed food. So the conclusion I'm coming to, you know, from the fish and from the turmeric and from, you know, the studies on, oh, juice. I shared this with you like 2-3 weeks ago. They found that people who drink juice but don't eat the fiber, this is specific to fruits. People drink fruit juice, like you drink orange juice every day or something like that, but don't actually eat the orange, it increases the risk of diabetes. Whereas if you actually eat the orange, you get the exact same amount of juice, it's not neutral. It actually decreases your risk of diabetes. So, I just find this whole thing fascinating, and I'm just, I guess, kind of blithering here. So let's pick up some of your phone calls. Gene in Malta, Illinois. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Well, let me switch to get off.
Gene, you're on the air.
Yeah, I know. This is your jealous lawyer who has so far avoided the jail part. But anyway, a question that I wanted to ask either you or Bernie was about Tom DeLay's 10-year, you know, funding of 75 years worth of retirement and health benefits.
Right.
For post office retirees, what's going to happen? It'll be 10 years in, you know, next year.
Right. And at the end of that year, they stop making payments into that fund, and the fund just sits there and starts earning interest until 75 years from now when people start retiring. And, yeah, so, you know, they've got like $50 billion now or $40 billion in that trust fund. And so there's just going to be this giant trust fund. And the post office will have been badly wounded for a decade.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, these guys are all about destroying public institutions. If you've got a public institution that works, Republicans want to destroy it. That and the fact that unions traditionally are one of the major funding sources for the Democratic Party and the largest unionized employer in the United States is the post office. And so, you know, 2 + 2 here, right? The Republicans hate unions, therefore they hate the post office.
It's just amazing. What is that going to, cutting off payments, how will that help the post office?
Well, we'll see. It depends on how much damage has been done up to that point, whether they're in some kind of a death spiral or whether they can recover from it. And a lot's going to depend on the Postmaster General and the President, what they decide to do. Gene, thanks a lot for the call. Actually, I think the funding requirement will run out at the end of next year. So it'll be the next president who gets the benefit of it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
28 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this. Very haloidly ugly, the good. Sustainable Canada Dialogues. On Wednesday, this group of Canadian scientists unveiled a plan to make Canada's energy sector 100% renewable by 2035. Their plan, which is titled Acting on Climate Change, calls for, among other things, a nationwide carbon tax, the elimination of all fossil fuel subsidies, and the adoption of energy-efficient transportation practices. The move to a renewable economy won't be easy, and the scientists behind this report acknowledge as much, but it's absolutely necessary if we want to hold off climate devastation. Good on Sustainable Canada Dialogues for helping point us the way toward a greener future. The bad, Bill O'Reilly. During Wednesday's episode of The Factor, the Fox so-called news host said that President Obama had nothing to do with the assassination of Osama bin Laden. Seriously, not kidding. Check it out.
Barney Frank couldn't give me one, and you can't give me one either. Not one accomplishment in 6 years
Osama
overseas.
Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden.
U.S. intel and the Navy SEALs taking him out.
Right. Like, it's not like he freaking ordered it or anything. Oh, and by the way, Bill, even if President Obama wasn't with those Navy SEALs when they took out bin Laden, he was a lot closer to the action than you were when you saw those photos of dead nuns and then said you saw them in person. Just saying. And the very, very ugly Fort Wainwright. The Alaskan military base is under investigation this week for hosting something called Racial Thursday, where service members were allowed to hurl racial epithets at each other without being punished. One soldier stationed at Fort Wainwright told the Army Times about his experience with Racial Thursday. He said, "A soldier I'm pretty good friends with, he was getting picked on the whole entire day until we were off work. He's Latino. They were calling him wetback, border jumper, those kind of jokes. He would say some jokes back, but he got to the point where he wanted it to stop. He and another soldier almost got into a fight, and guys had to step in between them and keep them apart." I think it's safe to say that this is not how the so-called defenders of the free world should behave. It's very, very ugly. That's amazing. So Netanyahu says he's in favor now of a two-state solution. However, his party, Likud, and all the people in it, they're opposed to a state, or many of the people in it, particularly the high-profile political people, they're opposed to a two-state solution. Amazing. Tony in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. First of all, I want to say I love your show, and I have a lot of respect for you.
Thank you. It's not necessary to start a call with that way, but thank you.
Well, I want to disagree with you about – you had a guest on yesterday. First of all, I want to say my wife is Palestinian. She's from Ramallah in the West Bank. Mm. And the assertion that Palestinians choose violence over peaceful means, sort of comparing them to if they went like Gandhi or if they went right. like, you know, MLK, that things would be better. And I want to tell you that this has been going on. There have been the Palestinian Authority and these groups have been trying peacefully to resolve these atrocities that happen as we speak.
I know.
Daily. And they are I mean, humiliated. I mean, it's not, it's a joke. Mm. And then, secondly, you know, it starts from the beginning. I mean, you got to understand the whole thing. And for us, okay, it's a comparison to the way we were with the Indians. You know, for a long time, they were evil savages. And, you know, we basically decimated them.
Right.
Humiliated them, killed their I mean, you know the history.
Sure. And well, now we have a two-state solution with them where one of the states is not quite a state, which is the Indian reservations that don't do well by Native Americans.
Of course.
Yeah, and our reservations are nowhere near as bad as Gaza. But,
okay.
You know, it's...
The checkpoints, they won't let you... First of all, they blew up one of the hospitals in Gaza.
Right.
So now they have to go to these border crossings to have a baby. And they, whether they feel like it or not, they'll let you in. And so people are having babies at border crossings. This goes on so much. One of my wife's relatives, they just chopped down his olive grove that was there for 50 years so that they could start building a settlement. They have this checkerboard of places to live, and they can't go around. I mean, it's absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
It makes me want to cry now. I mean, I can't believe it, the things that they're doing. And then America could stop it tomorrow. They really could.
I'm not sure we could stop it, but we could stop paying for it. I mean, the fact that we're sending $3 billion a year over to Israel, and then they're using this in ways that I think most Americans, if they knew what was going on, would be horrified by. It's time for us to reevaluate our special relationship with that country, in my opinion. And it doesn't mean that we end it. It means that we say, you know, get with the program, become a little more progressive, become a little, you know, deal with other people as if they're human beings rather than objects or subhumans. This is, you know, as I said yesterday, Israel is an apartheid state. Israel was, you know, negotiating with South Africa to sell them nuclear weapons back in the day when South Africa was an apartheid state. Israel and South Africa, P.W. Botha and F.W. de Klerk, those guys, they understood how things are in Israel right now. And that and you know, South Africa has demonstrated, I think, that an apartheid state can survive doing away with apartheid. And arguably the United States should have demonstrated the same thing. Doesn't mean that there's not going to be continual, you know, low-level problems going on. I mean, here in the United States, we have problems with race. In Israel, they will have problems for a long time, but it can be solved. Tony, thank you for the call. Well said. Well said. Carol in Dillon, Texas. Hey, Carol, what's up?
It's not Texas. It's Montana.
Oh, Montana. My apologies.
Oh, well, I'm trying to figure out how to get around voter suppression. I got suppressed.
How so?
I am still madder than a stomped wet hen.
Uh-huh. What happened?
Well, I vote by mail because I'm I vote absentee.
Right.
Well, I even paid the dollar for the postage that they asked for.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have the right sort of paper or what have you to prove that I am an American citizen, and I've lived here for most of my adult life.
So you got busted by the
years.
You got busted by Texas's voter ID voter suppression law.
Yeah, well, this is Montana.
Oh, Montana, I'm sorry.
I don't know what Harry Perry's doing down there, but I'll tell you what, our Republican House and Senate here in Montana has passed that you have to have voter ID in order to vote.
Right.
It doesn't matter how long you've lived here. It doesn't matter whether you ought.
Right.
You better have the ID.
Right.
And
Carol, what do you say to the folks who, you know, I mean, I get Republicans on this program all the time, and I say this is just designed to drive down the votes of your students, old people, and minorities. And they say, well, wait a minute, you've got to have ID to buy, you know, Sudafed in a drugstore. You got to have ID to get on an airplane. Why don't you have ID?
I don't buy Sudafed, and I don't get on airplanes, believe
there you go.
Me.
So you don't have a driver's license, Carol?
No, I'm 74 years old. We'll be 75 pretty soon, and I'm losing my vision, so I don't
You are exactly the vote that the Republicans want to suppress, because you would be somebody who would
better
be
believe it. Who and would, I want to know how many more in Montana were suppressed like I was.
Probably anybody who's old enough that they no longer drive and no longer has a driver's license, which could be a lot of people. It might be, you know, more than half all the old people in Oklahoma. I mean, who knows? But, yeah, Carol, this is a serious national problem. The Republican Party has figured out, and in fact, there's some polling that just came back. You can see it over at Democratic Underground right now. Only 5% of voters who claim that they are Republicans are people who are not white. Only 5%. This is a so 95% of Republican voters are white. Only 91% of voters in 1900 were white. It's like the Republican Party is whiter than the electorate was 120 years ago. It's amazing. So anyway, that's so what the Republicans have figured out is, you know, if they're only going to have white people voting for them and the percentage of white people in our population is declining and the percentage of people of color is increasing, then the only way that the Republicans can stay in power, I mean, they've got two options. One, become a more inclusive party and invite in, you know, people of color and multiple races. Or two, pass voter ID suppression laws in state after state after state and draconianly enforce them and throw people off the voter rolls, which is what Chris Kobach in Kansas is doing, the Secretary of State of Kansas. He's put together a list of so-called dual voters, people who are registered to vote in multiple states, in his mind, or have similar names in multiple states, so that they can, the Republicans just go in and knock thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people's names off the ballots, arguably, presumably, because their names are Hispanic. In fact, there was actually an example of this, or, you know, end with a vowel, or because they've got names that are common names among African Americans in the United States. So, Carol, this is how George W. Bush became president. His brother Jeb knocked 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls 3 weeks before the election in 2000. So that's what we've got to look out for, and it's a major problem. Carol, thank you for the call. We'll see where this all goes, but it's a really good question. How long will it be in the United States until we start encouraging people to vote? How long will it be before the dialogue changes from figuring out ways to make it harder to vote, which is what the Republicans have been doing for a couple of decades now, to figuring out ways, as Oregon just did, motor voter, right, where people can make it easier to vote.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday in just a moment. Welcome back. Michael in Sacramento watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Oh, hey, Tom, I got 2 points, and let me know if I have time for the second point. But the first one was earlier this week, you had a guest on, and he came up with Reagan cutting the taxes, and it increased tax revenue. And
right.
For 30 years, I've been hearing this argument, and about 5 years ago, a co-worker brought that up, and it just doesn't make sense. You cut taxes. How are you going to increase tax revenue? It makes no sense. So I finally looked it up, and I found 4 websites online. 3 of them were conservative, and 1 was liberal. They all said the same thing, that what Reagan did was the same thing that Kennedy did, is that he closed the tax loopholes. And nobody talks about that. Kennedy, I think it was 90% from the Eisenhower time, and Reagan, Kennedy cut it down to 70%, and then Reagan cut it from 70 to 50%.
Right.
But he closed the tax loopholes. That's why you had an increase. He raised taxes on the wealthy. It's the bottom line. And he did the same thing that Bush did after him and that Clinton did in his second term. They all raised taxes on the wealthy. And Clinton came up with a surplus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's incredible that nobody gets this. Oh, and the second thing is, well, it's not the second thing. It's part of the first thing. I'm sorry. That they used to make the conservatives make the argument that Obama had added $5 trillion to the deficit. But one of your callers said, well, Bush came in, Bush 2 came in with a surplus and added $10 trillion because all of a sudden there was a $15 trillion deficit. And Obama only added $5 trillion, but nobody talks about how Bush added $10 trillion to the deficit.
Right. Well, it wasn't 10. I think it was around 6 or 7. But, yeah,
well,
it was consequential, though. Yeah, when you say nobody talks about, basically what you're saying, I believe, Michael, is the corporate media in America doesn't talk about it. Because the corporate media in America is owned by fewer than a dozen companies who own more than 90% of all the media that we see. And those companies are either owned or run or both by people who are wealthy and Republican and concerned about that, you know, the top 1% in America. They don't care about anybody else.
They don't. And you're right. And the media is corporate media.
Yeah. And so
oligarch's mouthpiece now.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It's unfortunate. Do I have time for the second point?
We got about 20 seconds.
Okay, the second point is I called you a couple of weeks ago, and I said I had a bone to pick with you, and it was about Clinton and all the shows I've listened. You never mentioned the fact that Bill Clinton had tried to make it unlawful for rich people to have store their monies in offshore accounts.
Hmm.
And that when Bush came in, he vetoed that or negated that.
Right. Oh, interesting. I didn't know that, Michael. Thank you for pointing it out. If you've got any details on it, you can post it over at our blog at tomhartman.com, and I'll read it. I'll track it down, and hopefully it'll stick in my brain, and I can change my rhetoric. Michael, thank you for the call. Victoria Jones is up next. Talk idiot for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria Jones, live at the White House, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Well, it seems appropriate if we're going to start with Iran news to say happy Nowruz to you.
Oh, yeah. Happy Nowruz to you, too. Louise and I had dinner two nights ago with a friend of ours who's Iranian. This is a big deal holiday. It's kind of their New Year's celebration.
Yes, it's a very big deal. It's a very big deal. Despite that, though, the nuclear talks were actually scheduled to continue tomorrow, and that is, in fact, a new year. However, President Hassan Rouhani's 90-year-old mother has died. And because of that, the Iranian delegation is returning from Switzerland to Iran, and the talks have temporarily broken up, probably until the middle of next week.
Hmm.
Now, of course, the deadline is the 31st of March, which is the end of next week.
Right.
Meantime, it seems that the negotiations have made some progress, and both sides are determined to push for a deal. There are some major sticking points, and the French apparently are holding out the toughest of this side, the six world powers, in terms of what they're holding out for. The Iranians are opposing the idea of suspending UN sanctions. The Iranians want the UN sanctions lifted immediately.
Right.
The other world powers are saying, no, that needs to be done in stages.
Right.
And that is a major sticking point. There are several other sticking points. But
is it true, Victoria, that if the president was to negotiate an elimination of U.S. sanctions, whether it be immediate or staged, that it would require a congressional approval vote to do that?
Yes, that's U.S. sanctions as opposed to U.N. sanctions and E.U. sanctions. There are three sets of sanctions.
Okay.
But the U.S. sanctions, yes, there are some things he can lift on his own.
Okay.
But there are some U.S. sanctions that Congress does have to vote on.
Okay.
Now, the president has managed to get a bit of a window for himself. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee under Bob Corker had planned to move forward on a bill demanding a much louder say for Congress on sanctions next week, but they have delayed that until mid-April now.
Hmm.
So that's until after the deadline. But there is a new wrench in the works.
Oh, geez.
The new wrench, actually it's an older wrench than we realized, but it's new to us, is that House Speaker John Boehner is leading a delegation of Republicans to Israel.
Oh, geez.
And he is actually going to meet with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on March the 31st.
Why don't we just declare it our 51st state and then assert that their national health care program is being extended all across the United States?
Hey, how about that?
Yeah. I mean, we give them $3 billion a year. We could use that money for our health care.
How about that?
Indeed.
Well, now, of course, March the 31st is the deadline date.
Hmm.
So this is very interesting. And apparently this meeting was set up at the time that the speech to Congress was set up.
And nobody told the president about this either?
No.
Oh, geez.
So this is regarded as, shall we say, controversial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the Republicans are just establishing their own foreign policy shop, and it's amazing. It's amazing.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, that's a word, yeah.
The Obama administration has issued the first federal regulations for fracking since the drilling technique fueled a domestic energy boom. Now, there's been a lot of debate, a lot of delay about this, but the Bureau of Land Management today said that drillers on federal lands, must reveal the chemicals that they use, they have to meet certain well construction standards, and they have to safely dispose of contaminated water that flows back from fracked wells.
Geez, these are all things that the frackers would probably not be happy about. And I'm guessing that even though this only applies to federal lands, and I'm not just guessing this, I read this in your newsletter this morning, that the big freak out of the frackers is that the state governments will start using the federal standards as a guideline.
That's correct. They will be using it as a guideline. And that's one reason why it is definitely going to be significant. Now, the American Petroleum Institute says, despite the renaissance on state and private lands, energy production on federal lands has fallen, and this rule is just one more barrier to growth.
Right. Now, one other question, Victoria. We are now, you know, a week or so out from Tom Cotton, a Republican in the Senate, sending and 46 other senators sending a letter to the leader of a foreign government, to the leaders of Iran, trying to say basically ignore President Obama. I understand Mitch McConnell today sent a letter to all 50 governors of states in the United States saying ignore President Obama, only this time it had to do with something else.
With the EPA.
Right.
Now, I have to tell you that I have not covered this extensively, so I don't know very much more detail than that, but that is what he basically said,
right.
Yes.
Right. The Republican lawyers have figured out a way that governors might be able to blow up the president's efforts to reduce the poison in our air, and Mitch McConnell is helping the Republican governors figure out how to stick it to the president.
What we're seeing
is astonishing.
I mean, just putting on my analyst hat from out of space,
mm-hmm.
You're sort of seeing a fracturing of government.
I think it's 1855-ish.
Very interesting. You really are seeing this fracturing going on of the different parts of government of a kind of disunity that is very, very disturbing.
Yeah. Troubling, yeah. And what does it mean for the future of the Republic? And what does it mean for the future of these political parties?
Nothing good.
Yeah. Yeah. I find it just astonishing. I have not seen anything in the press about how Americans for Prosperity has actually a better ground game than the Republican Party. And Scott Walker is just popping up to the top. He, of course, you know, the bat boy for the Koch brothers. Is it because Americans for Prosperity are pushing him all around the country?
I have not heard that.
I would love to find out. That would be, I think, a big story. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Paul Krugman pointing out that the million-dollar asterisk. This is amazing stuff. Do we have Marianne with us? We do. Oh, I don't see her on the board. She must be. Oh, she's on Skype. Marianne Williamson is on the line with us. She is putting on a week from tomorrow in Los Angeles, March 28, 29. Sister Giant 3, presented by Marianne Williamson. I'll be there. Senator Sanders, who was with us for the first hour today, he'll be there. Sistergiant.com is the website. And Marianne, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. So tell us about Sister Giant.
Well, Sister Giant is a conference that's happening in Los Angeles in next weekend, March 28th, 29th, although people can also attend via live stream. And it is a conference that brings together you, Senator Sanders, Dennis Kucinich, Lisa Bloom, Chant Ugar, for a very in-depth discussion over the weekend about issues as various as getting the money out of politics, the corruption of our food supply, mass inequality, racial inequality, mass incarceration, and really developing a more conscious political conversation. I think a lot of the people that I have known in my work are people who are very interested in politics, but just feel that the conversation itself, the dialogue is so dense. It's so corporatized. It's so dominated by forces that have nothing to do with the real vigor of American democracy. And in the face of the systematic dismantling of our democracy that is going on at the moment, articulated, I thought, very well in the mission statement that you just read from the Poor People's Campaign, this is an effort, and we're going to be in Los Angeles. We're going to be live streaming as well. It's a fantastic group of people. Alan Grayson will be Skyping in. Keith Ellison will be Skyping in. And you're going to be there. So what could be better?
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. Why Sister Giant? Why juxtapose those two words?
Well, this started as a women's conference I did in 2010. It was Sister Giant, Awakening the Sleeping Giant of American Womanhood. And then the second one, a couple of years ago, was Women, Nonviolence, and Birthing New American Politics. So the Sister Giant reverberation is already there. And men are definitely invited. You know, I was going to call it Brother Sister Giant. That sounded clunky, Sister Brother Giant. And I figured, well, men read Mother Jones magazine. So I was hoping, I'm not sure how successful we've been, but I was hoping we could just make the segue and people could know, you know, it's Sister Giant, but it's for all of us. So
right.
Maybe I should have called it Brother Sister Giant, but.
Right. Sister Giant for boys and girls. come on by next weekend. It's right. No, but seriously, it's a week from tomorrow and
yes.
Sunday, and you can get tickets and learn, get information and whatnot over at sistergiant.com and or click on the link over at tomhartmann.com. Pardon me?
Yeah, and there's a video we're putting up this morning called The Revolution of Love that is just fantastic that people can find on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah, there's a video about this. There's a lot. This is a lot of great information. Marianne, what do you see as the most existential threats to our republic right now?
To me, getting money out of politics is the greatest moral challenge of our generation because I think it's the cancer underlying all the other cancers. The permanent war machine goes back to money. The dominance of chemical companies and big agriculture companies goes back to money. Oil companies dominating environmental policies goes back to money. Prison industrial complex, you name it. Drug policy, so much goes down and goes back to money. So until we deal with that, with the overturning of Citizens United, a constitutional amendment establishing public funding for political campaigns, I don't see anything other than peripheral healing. Do you, Tom?
I don't. I you know, you said that It was like you were channeling me. I mean, I totally agree.
Actually, I do. I mean, you know, you're one of the people that I've learned the most from.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I learned a lot. I've learned a lot from you over the years, too, Marianne. We're talking to Marianne Williamson, author and lecturer, former candidate for Congress, independent from California, about her conference, Sister Giant, which is coming up next weekend, not tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow, in Los Angeles or in Santa Monica. Yeah, where is this going to be?
It's at the Concourse Hotel at LAX. So right, it's right there. People who fly in, you're literally, as soon as you get off the airplane, you're already there.
Great. And then, if you don't want to fly in, you can watch it on the internet.
Right. Absolutely. Live stream it.
And how do people do that?
Sistergiant.com. You can see how you register for everything. And it's just so simple. Everything's just, everything's on our computer screen now. It's really quite amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
So streaming these events has become common. Although, if you can get there, if you can be there, there's something about being in the field of energy, actually in the room, that you can't beat.
Yeah, I totally agree. Your effort to run for Congress, I'm curious your thoughts on the state of politics now in California specifically. California has redrawn their congressional districts in a way that is not gerrymandered. How has that changed the political dynamic in California?
Well, you know, we have the top two open primary, mm-hmm. which sounds really good, but it's actually not good for independents, because independents traditionally were used to they'd wait until the primaries were over, because they didn't necessarily vote in the primaries, and then they knew that their independent candidates would be available on the ballot in November. Mm-hmm. Now, if you run as an independent candidate, which I did, your Democrat and Republican machineries, you're not going to beat that, so it's almost guaranteed that they will get those top two. So that's tough. It actually fortifies rather than cuts through the dominance of the two major parties. So that is something that I think had some good intention behind it by some people, but it's actually not so great. Right. In terms of the gerrymandering, yes, it was an independent commission, but still, for instance, in the district I ran in, the top two people came from the South Bay. Well, if you just look at the numbers of voters there, it was very difficult to break that. In general, though, having been a candidate, Tom, I'm more inspired. I'm not cynical. The system is rigged according to money, but in my case, people were so generous. It wasn't about money. It was just about too much that I didn't know about how to work the system. So I am more convinced that people really do long for a meaningful relationship with the public sphere. I think that people are waking up. I think you're one of the great awakeners day in and day out. And I think now we have the critical mass of energy that we need to really revolutionize, because we do need a new American revolution. We need a conscious, loving, nonviolent revolution in this country. And I think that the energy is there for it, but now we need to harness it politically. And I think, one of the feelings that I feel strongly about, Tom, is that on the right, among conservatives, they don't just train activists, they train candidates. On the left, we train activists, but we don't train candidates enough. And that's one of the things that I hope Sister Giant will do, is inspire people, women and men, to actually think about running. So I ran. I didn't win, didn't make it through my primary, but I like to think we impacted the ether some. I know we did. Dennis Kucinich said to me, every campaign has a win of some kind. And mm-hmm. I think that's true. And I think one of the wins is that many, many people who were involved with the campaign are now thinking, wow, I've been involved with a political campaign. Maybe I will do this someday. So we've got to get out there, Tom. You and I can't just always be trying to convince Congress people. We need to be a space that more and more encourages people to start running for things themselves.
Absolutely agree. And in the minute we have left before the break, Marianne, can you talk about the intersection of spirituality and politics in the United States?
Yes. Well, it's only an aberration historically that it's mocked the way it is. The abolitionist movement arose from the Quakers, and many of the leaders of the women's suffragette movement were Quakers. Dr. King was a preacher, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. So the idea of spiritual conviction is an important movement of social political change, always has been throughout the history of social justice movements in the United States. The Quakers found slavery intolerable from a moral, deep moral gut place, and because of their spiritual conviction, they found the idea of invoking its abolition and its alternative feasible through the power of things unseen. So this fact that people today act like it's some quaint New Age silliness, that's the aberration, because throughout our history, people have seen what a very serious thing it is indeed.
Fascinating stuff. Marianne Williamson, sistergiant.com is the website. 1 week from tomorrow and Sunday, the conference. You can watch it from live stream from anywhere in the world, or if you're in Los Angeles, you can show up. Marianne, thank you for dropping by.
Thank you. Thank you.
And for everything you do. You are such an important voice. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Once again, Marianne's website, sistergiant.com. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Looking for my mouse. There it is. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Tom, I was watching the news, and I saw some alcohol beverage control officers throw a young kid on the ground, slam his face into the ground, beat him up a bit, and handcuff him.
Yeah.
It seemed kind of strange to me. I'm in Oregon now, but I'm originally from New Jersey. We had alcohol beverage control officers in New Jersey. Their job was to arrest bartenders that were serving underage people and to close bars if they were serving liquor, or liquor stores if they were serving liquor after hours.
Right.
But they certainly didn't mess with the public.
That, you know, to the best of my knowledge, that's, you know, the way you're describing it is the way it's supposed to be. I'm still waiting to see some kind of an analysis or study on this thing, you know, investigation. It's not a good thing what happened at the University of Virginia, and with what was his first name? His last name was Johnson. This young man who was so badly beaten up by these cops. It was
horrible. His face was just covered with blood. It was, and he has 11 stitches in his head that messed up his hairline. It's horrible what they did.
I know. I'm with you, Ed. The Beverage Commission cops, you know, if their job is to arrest bartenders who are serving underage kids, you know, let them do that. But, you know.
Yeah, they don't arrest the kid. They arrest the bartender.
Right. And when they arrest him, they don't drag him out into the street and smash his head into the curb. So
they generally just give him a high-value ticket.
Yeah. Basically. Yep. Ed, thank you for the call. Mark in Chester, Connecticut, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, good. I have maybe three small snippets. You know, the president is charged with protecting the people from enemies, both foreign and domestic.
Well, actually, no, Mark. The oath that the president and everybody else in federal government takes is not to protect the people. It's to protect the Constitution.
Okay.
There's a big difference.
I understand. But, you know, so I wasn't completely clear on that, and that was the reason for my calling and asking.
Sure.
But even within the Constitution, you know, there's got to be some kind of pushback to what's going on against the American people.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, by just as a point of, you know, FYI, Article 2, Section 1, Section 1, Paragraph 8. The president, before he shall enter on execution of his office, shall take the following oath or affirmation, quote, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Okay.
And that's why, and Republicans don't want us to know that. They want us to think that the president's job is to protect you and me. So the president is like some macho guy with a bunch of guns, you know, the George Bush vision of the presidency. But actually, the founders had more in mind of, frankly, the Barack Obama version of the presidency, a constitutional scholar who can say, hey, wait a minute, that's not constitutional. You really want to do that?
So, you know, like things from like the treasonous 47 to...
Right.
All of the voting against the best interest of the citizenry here, or obstruction of legislation like infrastructure investments and other job creation, you know, the unfair taxation / benefits, who's really benefiting?
Right. And this is why the Republicans are so careful, Mark, to say that their proposals are within the boundaries of the Constitution. Because, you know, if they can make that claim, then any federal officer or official, including the president, would have to do, you know, what they say. I mean, they're stretching things horribly. Mark, thank you for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Chad in Dutton, Montana. Hey, Chad. Thanks for listening to Sirius. What's up?
I wanted to call because I'm an election judge.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a lady from Montana that was refused to she said she couldn't vote because she didn't have the proper ID.
Right. She didn't have a driver's license. She's 77. Yeah. She no longer drives.
Yes. And Montana's ID laws, if you have utility bill with your name on it and address, if you have she no longer drives, so she wouldn't have a vehicle registration. If you have a social security check or anything with your name and address on it,
mm-hmm.
you can vote. We cannot refuse you from voting if you have that. As a registered voter, everybody is mailed a registration card. Because all you have to do is show that card if you have that card. If your address does not match, you have to change out a change of address form, but you can still vote. I'm not saying I'm happy with our voter ID because I'm a judge in a small district, and virtually everybody that's working knows everybody that comes through, and we have to refuse you if you don't have something or send you home to get something.
Right, which is crazy.
But I have to follow it because I'm afraid even though I'm a small district in Montana, I would make Fox News if I let somebody vote because I knew who they were.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right.
But like I say, anything with your address on it, Costco cards, Sam's Club cards with your pictures on it, you're able to vote. So even though she may not have a state ID or a driver's license, she should have a registered voter card that they mailed her.
Mm-hmm.
She should have a utility bill or something that she has with her address on it. Somebody did something wrong there. For her not to be able to vote.
She did it by mail.
For everybody, but we have plenty of people in my district that vote by mail, and obviously they're mailing it to your address. So reason maybe if her voter ID card, not ID card, but registration card address did not match where she was having a mail, maybe they didn't do that.
Well, hopefully she's listening right now, Chad, and she'll check into it, find out, and then call us back and let us know what happened. Chad, thanks for the call and thanks for the information. Dan in La Mesa, California. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. My question to you is, are you aware of gang stalking? Gang stalking is the modern-day COINTELPRO, government-sponsored harassment of targeted individuals.
This is gang, S-T-A-L-K-I-N-G, stalking the gangs?
Yes, sir.
No, I'm not familiar with it.
It's called gang stalking.
Is this an effort to provoke gangs into doing things that they can then be arrested for?
No, it has nothing to do with gangs in the term of urban gangs. It's the government and private security contractors harassing individuals covertly, targeting individuals who are considered blacklisted or on terrorist watch lists. Probably none of them are terrorists. A good website is fightgangstalking.com. It's a reputable website.
Right.
But it's another, it's part of the whole, COINTELPRO and the church committees back in the 70s, it was the same thing, the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover harassing people, trying to get people to commit suicide, tried to get Martin Luther King to commit suicide.
Did you see did you see the piece on, it's up at the top of talkingpointsmemo.com right now, where James O'Keefe, the guy who ultimately lied about Acorn but nonetheless got them destroyed by his heavily edited piece being played over and over again on Fox so-called news, James O'Keefe had hired a guy who apparently was Middle Eastern, you know, looked the part, to try to get... He was going into an African-American neighborhood and saying, you know, let's kill some cops. I mean, literally encouraging people to kill police. And it blows my mind.
Similar.
Pardon?
It sounds very similar to gang stalking. It is about provoking the targeted individual into reacting or overreacting.
Wow. It's amazing. Dan, thanks for the information. I'll have to do some reading up. Gary in Medina, New York. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind?
Hey, Don, this is a good day. They can't just continue or cut into Social Security because that would cut billions of money dollars out of the economy, which would mean that these people would not be able to buy their stuff.
I agree. Gary, I don't think the billionaires want to end Social Security. I think they just want to have a piece of it. So you've got this $2.5 trillion.
They are getting a piece of it. They are getting a piece of it because they're, people are buying their stuff.
Right.
And then they'll put people to work, and those people have money to buy more of their stuff. So they cannot cut it. They can't cut it because basically, Social Security is corporate welfare.
Mm.
I mean, without Social Security, they wouldn't be able to sell their stuff. I mean, if the economy starts going down and they need to get the economy going, all they have to do is give raises to Social Security and just put more money into the economy, and they can buy more stuff, and then people will have to go to work to make that stuff.
You're right.
And then they have more money, and so they'll have to make more stuff. So, yeah, they can't cut into it. Basically, what they need to, they can raise it to it. And same thing is going with minimum wage. If they raise minimum wage, people can buy more stuff. People will have to go to work to make that stuff.
Yeah, these are, Gary, the ways that Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, and Dwight Eisenhower got us out of the Great Depression and paid off the debt from World War II. We were about as badly in debt after World War II as we are right now after Afghanistan and Iraq. And we didn't cut back on public services to pay it off. Dwight Eisenhower instead spent more money to stimulate the economy, building the national highway system, expanding Social Security, expanding the unemployment program, expanding unionization in the United States. Gary, your analysis from a demand side point of view is totally spot on. Well said. Thank you for the call, and thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour here on Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Anything Goes Friday. You're on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with more of your calls right after this. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in the place where despair is not an option. By the way, just Danny Schechter, who was just this brilliant guy. He's a great progressive. And he just died at the age of 72 of pancreatic cancer, just passed away. He was a regular on this program. It's been probably a year since Danny's been on, maybe even a little longer. So I'm guessing he's been sick for a while. But Danny used to be on this program with some regularity, and great guy. So rest in peace, or bask in the light. David in Auburn, Washington. Hey, David, what's on your mind?
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hey, David.
This gang stalking, it sounds like the story of my life. As an openly gay man for 40 years, I've been through plenty of that kind of stuff.
Oh,
but to my point today is, with tax filing coming up here, I was wondering how many people, I know you guys are all aware of it, but that the government is nonprofit. And it's funny because I know the oligarchs and the plutocrats, they're all aware of this. But I would recommend to the taxpayers to save all their receipts and question their accountant to make sure that every deduction they possibly can is filed so that they can get as much of that money back as they can, because they say there's a separation of church and government. Well, government is actually, or church or religion is a form of government, and that it's the whole truth around it is that the government is giving a lot of money back to people if you know when to file these applications, the window of opportunity, as they put it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, David, thank you for the call. It sounds an awful lot like this whole movement, sovereign citizens thing, that if you file the right forms with the government that you don't have to pay any taxes and all. It's very strange stuff. Jackie in Houston, Texas. Hey, Jackie, you wanted to mention Danny Schechter?
Hey, Tom. Yes, I did. I was a friend of Danny's over online only, but we spent many hours on the phone talking and on projects.
Mm-hmm.
But, I just wanted to alert people. I mean, I'm one of millions
that are Danny fans and friends. Yeah. But his there's a Danny Schechter Memorial Facebook page that I spent half the night weeping over because reading about other people's stories and experiences with him. There were things I learned I didn't know about. I didn't know that he had worked so brilliantly and written 6 books about Mandela, that he was so instrumental in moving things forward to in terms of getting rid of apartheid, and that he was a freedom writer here in this country. I mean, Danny was somebody that did not hesitate to speak the truth.
Yeah.
And he called out his colleagues who weren't living.
Yep. May we all be as effective. Jackie, thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing that memorial to Danny Schechter. Brian, in Lutz, Florida. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? It's good to talk to you. Well, I'd first like to say I have your books. Walking the Blues Away is a book I really like.
Yeah, I think
I'd like to talk. Excuse me?
I was going to say, I think it's probably the most important book I've written, Walking Your Blues Away. And it's one of the most obscure, but it's the one book that, well, actually I've written several books in psychology, but I think it's one of the most important. Back to you, Brian.
I'd like to talk. I heard Mike Malloy talk about, it was really grim, about the SEALs dying out in San Francisco
Bay Area.
The other question I have is bees. Do you think like cell phones and all the microwaves, all the air, do you think that's got anything to do with dying of the bees plus the pesticides?
There is some speculation that cell phone towers might, when they're in close range, because they're using microwave frequencies, they may screw up bees' ability to tell directions. That science is fascinating. It's not quite as conclusive as others. The big problem with colony collapse disorder appears to be, and again, the science is in dispute because the big pesticide companies are paying scientists to dispute it, just like they did with tobacco, like they did with climate change, like they did with sulfur dioxide and acid rain. But it appears that the neonicotinoids, the compounds, the insecticide compounds made out of nicotine, these neonicotinoids are damaging the immune systems of the bees to the point where the bees are vulnerable to a fungus that then causes the colony collapse disorder. And in fact, I think it was the European Union earlier this week came out with guidelines against the neonicotinoid pesticides. So that's what I know about it, Brian, which is not a great deal.
Yeah,
but the seals dying off, the seals dying in San Francisco, that apparently is caused by global climate change. The ocean currents have shifted as the ocean's gotten warmer. The cold water's moved farther out to sea, and the seals live on small fish, and these small fish like cold water. They're small, oily, fatty fish, you know, the anchovies and sardines and kind of thing. And, you know, the sea lions can't get any, and so they're literally starving to death. And this is climate change. Brian, thanks for the call. We're facing some real challenges here, and we need a government and politicians who are willing to actually address these things. Robert in Boston. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Yes, you know, if you're from Boston in the 1960s like me, you remember Danny Schechter, the news dissector.
That's right. He started in local television or local radio in the Boston area, didn't he?
Calling about the Israeli elections, and I just want to make a point. It's a bit of a fantasy, but even as we speak today, there could be a center-left government with Herzog as prime minister. It would take just one phone call from Cologne to the Israeli Arabs, and that would form a coalition of 63 members of Knesset with the rest of the left and center-left.
Right. It's pretty unlikely, though, isn't it?
Yes, it's very unlikely. The Arabs have always said they won't be in the government, and Halon appears to be going to become the most left member of a right coalition rather than the most right member of a center-left coalition.
Right, right. So in all probability, Netanyahu will have won his little game with John Boehner and the Republicans here in the United States. It's reaching the point where we should just declare Israel the 51st state. Robert, thank you for the call. David in Tulsa. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon. I have a couple of things here. First of all, I was going to tell you that I was one of those people back in the early 70s over at the University of Oklahoma that was protesting against the SAVAK agents that were openly operating on campus. They were trying to photo the Iranian students that were protesting the Shah.
And we right. SAVAK was the Shah's secret police, and he sent them all over the world to look for his opponents.
Oh, they operated quite openly in the United States and on college campuses. And you can tell either a swarthy Middle Eastern man in his late 40s and 50s with shiny shoes and everything versus all these young kids.
Right.
And they'd get letters telling them as they were identified to come home. We've imprisoned your father. We've imprisoned your brother. Come home or we will execute him. And then we'd find out later on, like one of them went home and then he was executed.
Yeah.
And this kind of... You know, and I'm dovetailing this into what's going on with Israel, because Bibi sounded like, when he was doing his speech, he sounded like he was describing Saudi Arabia,
yeah,
not Iran.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody forgets about what happened with the U.S. Liberty by Israel.
The USS Liberty, I think the only book that even dealt with that was Daniel, who's the guy who wrote Puzzle Palace? Anyway,
I'm not sure.
He's got one chapter in his last book about the USS Liberty and how, 34 U.S. soldiers were killed by Israel in that unprovoked attack
Navy sailors, and they were told not to fire on the Israeli jets.
Right.
You know, and it was just to this day, they hadn't even really apologized about it.
No, and in fact, much of the speculation and what it says in I wish I could remember this guy's last name. I want to say Morris Berman. That's not him. But in any case, the guy who wrote The Puzzle Palace, he wrote this other book, which The Puzzle Palace is the book on the NSA. And James Bamford, he's been on this show a couple of times. How could I forget his name? Anyhow, he was suggesting that, I believe he was suggesting, it might have been that I read it someplace else, that one of the reasons why the Israelis attacked the USS Liberty is the USS Liberty was just off the coast of Gaza and it was documenting war crimes being committed by Bibi Netanyahu.
Right, because this was during the time of the Arab Israeli War.
Right.
And now, remember also here, tying the Likud party to the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin.
Right.
Who was running as a peace candidate and trying to negotiate.
But the Likud party's never been tied to Rabin's assassination, has it?
No, not officially. But, yeah. I mean, you know, it's kind of one of those things of who else profited by it. It certainly didn't. There certainly wasn't any change in the politics.
Right.
And here, being from Oklahoma, you know, I'm well aware of what the reservations and the situation with the Indian population here, because I've dealt with my friends of mine that are Indian, and you know, it's they're third class citizens around here.
Yeah, it's tough running an apartheid regime. We're doing a bad job of it here in the United States with Native Americans, and the Israelis are doing a worse job of it with Palestinians. David, thank you for the call. That's fascinating stuff. We'll be back with more of your calls here on Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Strange stuff going on with Uber in Washington, D.C., by the way. It's all of a sudden, there's these extra charges with every ride, it seems. Welcome back. Maureen in Warren, Michigan, watching on Free Speech TV. We used to have some good friends who lived in Warren. It's a great little town just outside of Detroit. Hey, Maureen, what's up?
Like Eminem.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, I have two comments for you, Tom.
Okay.
The first one is I watched the first half of the ex-prosecutor from California.
Oh, Vince Bugliosi, the helter-skelter prosecutor, yeah.
Yeah. I would praise any prosecutor that would follow through to the up on this.
Yeah. Well, he's got it out in a movie now that'll live longer than he will, and who knows? I mean, it's entirely possible.
Okay, and then the other comment I had, it's old news now, but a week or so ago. The guy in Arizona, the white man, who shot and killed somebody in a motel and injured four other people. And I consider it reverse discrimination because when he went back to the motel, they tried to talk him down off the ledge, and they tasered him.
Hmm.
They didn't shoot him.
Yeah.
And he already killed somebody and shot four other people.
Wow. Maureen, I don't know the details of that story, so I can't comment on it. But thanks for the call, and thanks for bringing up Vince Bugliosi. It's great stuff. Jose in Tamarack, Florida, you wanted to talk about the Israeli election?
Yes, sir.
Hey.
I just basically just wanted to make a comment in regards to what Netanyahu said prior to the election, about as long as he was prime minister, there would never be a Palestinian state. The fact of the matter is that as despicable as Netanyahu is, for once he told the truth. Because it has been Israeli policy for decades, since 1967, to never have a Palestinian state. And
right.
They, made sure of that by all the facts on the ground, all the settlements, so a viable Palestinian state will never be possible, under the present circumstances.
Right.
So, I don't see ever there, being a two-state solution. There's only a one-state solution, right now. That's viable, and I think that the Palestinians are fighting the wrong fight. They should be fighting for full citizenship and being totally inclusive in Israeli politics, and that's the only solution for Israel. Of course, that would mean that they would stop existing as Israel.
So you're saying that the Palestinians, rather than taking the position that we should be a separate country, should be taking the position that we are Israelis, this is Israel, we want to register to vote, and then all of a sudden you're going to have, 4.5 million people on the West Bank and Gaza get integrated into the political process of Israel. How much longer is Israel going to be the Jewish state if that happens?
Yeah, no, it will stop being a Jewish state,
right.
And this is, this is the struggle. But, the way things are now, there will never be a Palestinian state coexisting besides Israel.
Right.
Never. I mean,
but Israel has to, they have to ultimately come up with, they have to make the decision of, are we going to be an apartheid state like South Africa, which is what Israel is right now with what's going on in Gaza and the West Bank, or are we going to be a more inclusive nation? Are we going to invite these folks in? Or is there some third way that maybe nobody has thought of? I don't know. Jose, thank you. It's an interesting contribution. I appreciate the call. We'll be back. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the folks at the various organizations that syndicate our program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show all around the country, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room. Hey, how you doing? To Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. So weird stuff going on here in town with Uber. It's just the last couple of weeks, and maybe it's just because Congress came back, but I don't think so. Is that their model is that when there's a certain level of demand, when the number of people looking for a car exceeds the number of cars available or starts to approach the number of cars available, then they start raising prices. It's called surge pricing. And I've noticed over the last couple of weeks that just like surge pricing is happening all the time when it normally doesn't on Uber. And I use Uber a fair amount. I mostly take the trains, but, a couple times, absolutely, 3 or 4 times a week, I'm using Uber every week. And it's just fascinating. I am now starting to use cabs instead of Uber because there's constantly this surge pricing. And then last night I had an Uber driver who was saying, a lot of us are also driving for Lyft. And I pulled up Lyft, and Lyft didn't used to have any drivers in D.C. Now there's like 10 or 12 of them that I'm seeing on the map, you know, instantly available to me. It's I think that what's going on is there's a whole lot of fine-tuning and shaking out of the algorithms and business models for Uber and their competitors. And it's just a fascinating process to watch. But what it's doing for me is it's encouraging me to walk the extra six blocks and take the metro every day. Tony in Mayville, Wisconsin. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great, but I'll get better. How about you, Tony?
Same way.
Okay.
My question for you is Germany, Tom. I have heard you on your program mention that nobody has ever cut their way to prosperity. And I'm pretty sure Germany has had austerity measures there for quite some time. So I'd like to listen to you comment on how Germany's economy is going, and did the austerity measures work, or did they use that in a combination of raising taxes?
Well, you know, Germany said to Greece, you must make your national health care system limited to 1 year. Nobody can have health insurance after 1 year unless they're working. And saying this to a country that had a 26% unemployment rate, that has never been imposed on Germany. The Germans said to the Greeks, you have to cut back on your food programs for poor people. You need to pay us back first. That has not, in the modern era, that has not been done to Germany. Now, the last time that this kind of austerity was imposed on Germany, it was through the Treaty of Versailles I forget what year the Treaty of Versailles, maybe 1919, whenever the Treaty of Versailles was signed. And there's a virtual consensus among World War II scholars, Tony, that the Treaty of Versailles, which was designed to punish Germany for their expansionist, aggressive behavior in World War I, that the Treaty of Versailles is the reason why Hitler came to power and Germany went into World War II, is because we were damaging them so badly by our austerity demands.
Yeah, but how is their economy doing right now? Because they have done austerity programs over the last number of years.
Which austerity programs?
The number one economy in Europe.
Pardon?
Or what I've heard was a mistake.
Tony, I think you might have been hearing wrong. Maybe I have been, but I don't think so. Maybe the Germans are calling something that they're doing austerity, but it's not like the austerity they have been inflicting on Portugal, on Greece, on Italy, on Spain, and Ireland. The German economy is doing fine, thank you very much, because they protect their exports. You know, we're using a VAT tax as functionally a tariff. And because they, you know, every company in Germany that has more than 1,000 employees, half of their board of directors has to be made up of union representatives. The union representation in Germany is well over 50%, which means basically everybody in the country has the equivalent of a good union job.
Isn't that something, huh?
Yeah, it is. And say what? And everybody in Germany gets free college. So, I don't think that you can call any of that austerity. Tony, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Bill in La Quinta, California. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, good morning, Tom, or good afternoon. I have a question about our involvement with the State of Israel and why it is not in conflict with the separation clause in the Constitution. I've asked Americans United for Separation of Church and State that question, and I've never gotten an answer because I sense they probably get a chunk of money from the Jewish people. But the State of Israel, by its own description, it describes itself as the Jewish state. We can't give a voucher to a parochial school kid in this country because it violates the separation.
Well, we do all the time, actually.
We're giving $10 million a day to a country that's defined by its religion.
Right.
How is that not in conflict with the separation of church and state?
Well, it's not the United States. So, the separation of church and state is... That language does not appear in the Constitution. It's from a letter by James Madison. But in essence, you know, there can't be a religious test for a position in the government of the United States. That's, you know, the I'm assuming that that's what you're referring to. Or the First Amendment that says that, you know, religion, there can't be an official religion of the state. But that's here in the United States. What we give to Israel is foreign aid. It's not like aid to the states kind of thing. So, Bill, I understand your point. And I don't disagree with it. but it's, you know, technically it's in kind of a gray area. Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us today. Thank you so much for participating in our democracy here in the United States. Please remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. You've got to show up. You've got to participate. Tag, you're it. Have a wonderful weekend. See you next week.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.